This is episode number 774 of the Secret Identity Podcast, and today in What's New, we're going to give our wrap-up of AvonCon 2017. We'll talk about Warlock 5 and also DC's new digital TV service. Our comics this week will be The Old Guard number 2, Batman number 21, Spencer and Locke number 1, and The Flash number 21. And finally, this week's creator spotlight is Mr. Justin Bow, the creator of the Fey Noir role-playing game, who I spoke to about a new Kickstarter project to fund a comic related to the Fey Noir world.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you!
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
Good, clean, wholesome fun.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here, as always, with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
Doing well, and I will say for the first time in a while, I would rather skip everything we're doing right now and run right to the comic reviews, because I am excited about Batman 21 and Flash 21.
Not that we're not normally excited to talk about comic books, but you're right. I think lately, we've talked so much in our news segment lately about like the woes of Marvel or the missteps of Marvel or even some of DC stuff that we have some different news today, which is good. We have solid positive news today, which I'm really excited about. And we're going to start by talking about our trip to AvonCon 2017, which happened it'll be 2 weeks ago as you listen to this particular episode. What a fantastic show. I'm like, as we've talked about before, the big shows are the big shows,
yes,
right? But some of these smaller shows that we go to now turn out to be an absolute blast for a variety of different reasons, but mainly because they're small shows. You get to spend time with people. We always are meeting new people at these shows. The people that put this show together, you had Tina Panic and Marissa Hicking from the Avon Public Library who put together the show. And I want to say it was their third year,
yes,
of doing AvonCon. And each year they have a theme. And this year's theme was the rise of the villains. And so everything that they did in terms of programming and stuff like that was villain themed. We ran into our good friend Matt Ryan there,
yep,
of Free Lunch Comics, who was there, and he did an art fight where he has people battle, you know, in terms of their, you know, drawing against one another, a particular topic. He did one of those at the BingCon last year. And we had a variety of panels throughout the day. You did your Doctor Who 101 panel, but flavored it with the sort of villain side of things.
Yeah, you had to, because it was Rise of the Villains. And it was interesting that everybody in costume, 90% of them were in the villain side of things, which was really cool because it did. It went with the theme. But I really want to mention the fact that you and I believe I emailed Tina about this. You and I and Matt Ryan were outside in the rain. And a friend of Matt's whose name escapes me, I apologize. We were out in the rain waiting to get in because we all got there a little early. And we just started talking. We were talking about this glut of shows. We were talking about how it wasn't like it used to be. Matt was bringing up the fact that he goes, boy, I remember the first time we met, and you know, I wasn't even prepared to be interviewed by you guys because it was crazy and insane and I didn't know you guys. And he brought up the fact that when a promoter reaches out to him about doing a show, he said the first question he's now going to start asking is, why are you doing a show? And it made me think. And I know the bell was the wheels and everything were going off in your head too. And I think that the folks that put on AvonCon know why they were doing a show, and that was for the exact reason it was, to bring people in, to celebrate the hobby, to get people to – for a library, obviously, you want to get people in there to read and use the services, but that's not a bad thing. That is not a bad thing at all, and I will never begrudge the promoter that wants to do a show to make money, because if you don't make money, you're not going to do a show next year. But you could tell while we were there – every single person involved, whether or not they were into comics or not, were there to make sure everybody had a great time. And we were right next to the camera where you could take pictures with a green screen. Then you added a backdrop in.
Right.
And that was busy the entire time. And you could see the people at the information desk that were kind of running it. did not sit there and go, oh, somebody else. They started yelling from the other side, hey, hold on, we'll get you hooked up. And everybody just had a great time. It was a huge building. Talk about a library that is pretty nice.
What I kind of liked about it is that we were in the library. So yes. You had the library that had multiple floors, and you had – we were just in the library.
Yeah.
So, like, wherever there was space in between bookshelves or sort of an open area in different sections of the library, there would be tables of creators.
Yes.
And that was kind of awesome because we were just – there's nothing I like more – I probably talked about how nerdy I am about books before on the show, but like my favorite place in the world is to be in the library. Mm. Like my favorite job that I've ever had was when I was in college and I worked in a library at my school. And because I just used to love to be in the stacks of books, like just be there surrounded by books. So for me, like that's a win already.
Yeah.
To go to a library and just be hanging out in the library all day is cool, but it was – the library was open for business that day. So It wasn't just people that were coming to AvonCon. It was people who were bringing books in and were looking for books and were using the card catalog and were like, there was library stuff going on there too. So it wasn't just like they closed off the library for this thing. We were in the middle of the library.
If there was a Dewey Decimal System still around, people would try to be using it while we were there.
It was awesome. So then they had the programming, the panels. You did your panel on Doctor Who. I did a panel on sort of creating a memorable villain. And it was awesome because the people at the panels were asking lots of questions and everything like that. You and I went sort of back to back. So it was a nice break up to the middle of the day where we were there for a couple hours at our table. Then we went to do the panels. Then we came back. And those one day shows are just a blast because you hang out for the day, you go home. Sometimes with those longer shows where it's multiple days and stuff like that, especially when we're not staying over and we're just sort of going back home each day, that can get to be kind of a grind.
Yes.
This was just fun from start to finish, and they treated us amazingly well at that show. They had all kinds of swag that they gave us just for being guests there. Our lunch was paid for when we were there.
And I mean, those were awesome sandwiches.
You and I were just kind of blown away by the hospitality of it all. And again, Tina and Marissa did just a fantastic job of continually checking in with people, bringing water to the table and stuff like that. And it was much like we talk about Plastic City last year. It was one of those shows where lots of families came in, parents and kids coming in, fans of different things, fans of the same thing. And of course, we met the guys from Brick City Blockade there who are fellow podcasters. Yep. And so as soon as we ever meet anybody that is a fellow podcaster, we're nerding out over like, oh, well, yeah, tell us about your show and how do you do this and what have you been doing with this? And so it was one of those days where by the time we went home, my voice was pretty much gone.
Still is. Mine is. Yep.
Yeah. And you can hear it now for kind of both of us. And it's a week later. Just because it was fun to hang out and talk to people about cool stuff all day.
And you'll be hearing an interview I did in a couple weeks with Robin Vogt, who is one of the voices of the Brick City Blockade podcast network. A bunch of guys that just talk about Star Wars. A good friend of mine, R.W. Martin, who is a great, massive cosplayer. He does the best stuff. I see him all the time at the shows like in the eastern side of the state. He's part of the crew. So that is really cool that they've got a lot of people covering toys, the comic book side. RW does the cosplay things. They even have a correspondent in Australia. So it is a really cool thing. And you're going to like to hear from Robin because he, like myself, holds a lot of love for the prequel.
Yes. Yeah, you found some soulmates at this show. And that was really funny to me. So, yeah, it was a blast all around. Certainly, we would be very excited to go back next year. And I hope that it sounds like the show was successful enough that, of course, they're going to plan on doing another one next year. So we will keep people posted on that. That was a ton of fun. Other news this week, Matthew. Warlock 5 is a book that you're going to hear about again in the next episode when I do the Out of the Long Box about the first issue of that. But we talked about Warlock 5 over the past couple weeks because it's a series that was put out by Aircell Comics out of Canada in the 80s. And it was sort of a sci-fi mashup series that ran for, I think it was two volumes, 22 issues in the first volume and like 9 in the second one. And then it went away. Well, it was coming back because Ragnarok Publications was doing a Kickstarter campaign to fund a new volume of Warlock 5. And it is written by Cullen Bunn and Jimmy Johnston. And the artist on it is Jeffrey Edwards. And if you listened to the last episode of Secret Identity, then you heard my interview with Jeffrey Edwards about this series. And we talked about the Kickstarter that was going up. Well, the Kickstarter is now live. So you can go to the link that I will put in the show notes, and you can check out the Kickstarter. And again, this series, and I'll just give you a little bit of history on it, says originally created by Gordon Darry and Dennis Beauvais, Warlock 5 was published by Barry Blair, a Canadian comic book publisher, artist, and writer known for launching Air Cell Comics in the 80s. Fierce advocate for innovation in the themes, genres, and types of illustrations, Blair helped to bring titles to life that broke the narrative and graphic barriers at the time, including Warlock 5. The new Warlock 5, written by Cullen Bunn and Jimmy Johnson, illustrated by Jeffrey Edwards, colors by Andy Poole, letters by Ed Dukeshire, another name that we know, and it is a saga of betrayal, rivalry, magic, dragons, and killer robots. It's going to have a 60-page hardcover volume through this Kickstarter, and you can, of course, pledge different tiers. You can pledge a tier where you just get the digital version for less and stuff like that. But that Kickstarter is live now, and I will be talking more about that series in the next episode when I review the first issue, because when I saw the covers of the original series, they blew me away.
Mm.
And I went onto eBay, which is something I should not be doing, because I'm trying to get rid of print comics, Matthew. Here I am going on eBay, and I'm searching for runs of this stuff. Well, the complete run was on there. So I bought it.
Yep.
So I got it this past week, and I've been reading it, and it's absolutely awesome. So we're going to talk about that in the next episode. But in other news, Matthew, The Tick will return to comics again.
I saw that.
With the launch of a new series in August. It will be written by Cullen Bunn. We just mentioned Cullen Bunn.
Cullen is everywhere.
He is everywhere, dude. Who is also writing X-Men Blue, which is another book that we just talked about.
And I picked it up and read it on my own, and I liked it.
Yeah, this is the Cullen Bunn podcast now. it'll be written by Cullen Bunn and Jimmy Johnston. Oh, interesting. So Jimmy Johnston, who's also doing Micronauts. So these guys...
Holy crap, that's where I've heard.
We might have a little Palmiotti and Gray stuff going on here with Bunn and Johnston here, with art by Douglas Paskowitz, who is doing Arsenic Lullaby. The launch of the new series is timely, Matthew, because the new Amazon series also drops August 25th. So
cool.
They did a pilot episode of The Tick on Amazon, and then it got picked up for series, at least one season, and it is going to be coming in August. So both the new comic and the new TV series are going to be coming in August. I have a feeling we'll be talking about that quite a bit.
Yeah, and The Tick is one of those characters that I know you and I have a lot of love for, and it seems to try to make the inroads back. And I forgot who was doing the last – it might have been New England Comics. I think New England just constantly does it because I think that's where England is kind of stationed. But it keeps coming out. Like Free Comic Book Day had The Tick series that launched it again. And then it went away. It just never quite gets the legs. But man, whatever we got to do this time to make it stay, we vow to do it.
I think it holds a special place for us because of the cartoon.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like the cartoon was so good.
See, I was the live show where you were I was the cartoon.
Like for me, that, and I remember like we talked about this before when we were at United Fan Con and I picked up the bootleg DVD of it.
Yep.
And Sean Wong drew Chairface Chippendale for me on the inside of the DVD sleeve. Like, I was a huge fan of the Tick cartoon. The TV series was good. It wasn't exactly what I was hoping for out of that. So I'm hoping that this new Tick series is a little bit more, I don't want to say faithful to the comic because I understand that they have to adapt it.
Yep.
But I think it is a little closer to the comic. So I am totally looking forward to that and I'm excited about that. Also of interesting note on the digital television front, Matthew, DC Entertainment is expanding its digital footprint. The company is teaming with Warner Brothers Digital Network Group for a new digital service launching in 2018, The Hollywood Reporter has confirmed. Two of the first series offered on their new platform will be a live-action series, Titans, from executive producers Greg Berlanti, Akiva Goldsman, DC Entertainment President and Chief Officer, Creative Officer Jeff Johns, and Sarah Schechter, as well as the upcoming third season of the animated series Young Justice.
So that'll be great.
Titans live action.
Yes.
Third series of Young Justice. It says Titans follows a group of soon to be superheroes recruited from every corner of the DC universe. The series centers on Dick Grayson as he emerges from the shadows to become the leader of a fearless band of new heroes, including Starfire, Raven, and many others. The series is an adaptation of the comic book series, which launched in the early 60s. The team of teen superheroes first appeared in a 1964 issue of The Brave and the Bold as a junior Justice League featuring Robin, Kid Flash, and Aqualad. They were later joined by Wonder Girl and Green Arrow's sidekick Speedy. The series was later revived in 1980 and relaunched as the New Teen Titans, aging the characters to young adults. The most recent Titans volume ran from 2008 to 2011. So, live action, yep. Starfire, live action Raven, live action Robin. That's pretty awesome.
I am in. Teen Titans have always been my favorite group, and it's been great now to have a great Teen Titans comic and a great Titans comic where during the New 52, we won't go into the details about how much we did not like the characters in it, but it is so good to have these guys back and treated right. You've got the greatest characters. You also have a lot of ways to do a lot of teen angsty things. And even when the new Teen Titans launched in 80 or 81 with Marv Wolfman and George Perez, I was, I think, in seventh or eighth grade. I couldn't wait to be a teenager because I was reading these adventures going, I know I don't have super speed and I know my friends don't do all this stuff, but man, I want to be a teenager and fall in love and get my heart broken. And yeah, that happened.
And then you were like, actually, this not so great.
No,
I'm not a big fan of this.
Should have picked another comic.
I'm interested about this news because of the idea that DC is going to have their own digital platform. So imagine a Netflix for DC.
Yeah.
Where you could imagine that in the future, maybe some of their CW properties migrate over to this new thing. Now, again, the CW is it CW Seed, which is like their online digital thing? That's where the Vixen animated series was happening. So, I mean, they've dabbled in that stuff before. I'm interested to see kind of where this goes. I'm not so sold on the idea that you want to have just your own little... I understand why they want to do it. I don't know that that's necessarily going to be successful for them to just have like a, you have to subscribe to DC TV in order to get this particular series, because people are already paying whatever they're paying to Netflix and Hulu and that kind of stuff. So I get worried about them creating this additional service that you may have to subscribe to. I cannot possibly see this being free.
No.
You know what I mean? Like they're... In just doing like ad-supported stuff, I just don't see that happening because they already use YouTube for their DC All Access stuff, which is ad-supported, and I just don't see them doing that for free. So the idea that they might have their own little app or their own little subscription service where you pay money to. Now, if they decided to do something that was capitalizing on everything, so if they had like a DC subscription service where you got to read comics and to watch cartoons, and to watch live-action stuff, and they brought back some old stuff, maybe like Smallville or older, you know, Lois and Clark or that kind of stuff, and you could watch all of that kind of back history, now you're getting me a little bit more interested in that. Like, I don't know that launching with a couple of new shows and maybe a little bit of extra content is going to be enough. I think that you have to sweeten the pot. And I think both DC and Marvel have the ability to say, look, you can pay $10 a month, and we will give you access to everything. You'll get, like for Marvel, you'll get your Marvel Unlimited subscription where you can read all these back issues of our comics. You'll get maybe one series new as it comes out every month. You'll get to watch all the old episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and you get to watch all the Marvel cartoons. Like that kind of stuff to me makes more sense.
If you remember a little while back, we talked about Amazon and DC Entertainment kind of working together on some things. And I'm wondering maybe... it might be part of Amazon Studios.
Yeah, and I don't know enough about that stuff now because I know that some of the major networks like HBO and stuff like that, there are, I'm trying to think, is it Shudder? Shudder, you know, the horror thing, Shudder. You can add that to like your Netflix Prime subscription. It's like an extra fee, but it's like adding an extra package to your cable package. Like if you have the Amazon Prime subscription and you're getting the video every month through Amazon Prime, you can add like the Shudder channel for $5 a month or something like that. So I could see them maybe as being an add-on to an existing service. Like, okay, you have Netflix, but if you want to add the DC content to next Netflix instead of paying $10 a month, you pay $12 a month.
Because that would make a lot more sense.
They should go where there's already a base as opposed to going somewhere new. So if it's Amazon, great. You already have a built-in audience with Amazon. Hulu, I'm not that impressed by. I don't like their model. But I think either Amazon or Netflix, if you were to be sort of an a la carte add-on to That, I could see that happening. But if you're going to go it alone, I think you have to offer more content than just these original program things. Like that's nice, but that's not going to get a bunch of people to subscribe to paying you monthly.
Yeah, because I wouldn't do it. Not just for one TV show.
I mean, it's not like we're going to go hand DC a bunch of money every single month, Matt.
That's stupid. That's why would we ever do anything like that?
Why would we give DC a bunch of money every month? So we're going to talk about some comic books now and how we give DC money every month.
I gave him $2 extra this month.
Before we talk about comic books, Matthew, I have to put out it's a cry for help at this point.
Uh-oh.
I don't know how many more times I can say that my beard is going to just fall out of my face at this point.
I sent a message to Gary.
VikingOilsLLC.com is the entity that is keeping my beard alive right now.
And you're
and it's hanging on by a thread because I'm scraping the bottom of the barrel with my beard oil right now.
Yep.
I think it's Blood Moon is the beard oil.
I love the smell of that one, too.
I need it. Like, I'm hopelessly, you know... it's just got me in its thrall now. I can't get away from it. If I stop using it, I fear that my beard will just fall out. And I have to tell you, I have a good beard story to sort of wrap this up. So before I forget, it's VikingOilsLLC.com. That's where you want to go. And they have seasonal products that come in, stuff that's more winter scented and you know, spring and summer and that kind of stuff. So beard oil, beard balm, all kinds of stuff over there. So I did a training earlier this week at work. And for those of you that haven't seen me lately, I haven't shaved my beard yet. And every year for the past like 3 years, what I do is sometime in the fall, I just stop shaving altogether and I just let it grow. Mm-hmm. And I don't do anything with it pretty much until like April. This is actually longer than I let it go last year. So because we're now getting into May. So I did a training. My wife hates it. My daughter hates it. I like it. So I do a training. Thank you, Matthew. We do the training the other day. And after the training, people are shuffling out. And this woman who I've only just met at this particular day. Never met her before in my life. As everybody's sort of scuttling out of the room, she pokes her head back in the door and she says, I don't want this to be weird, but your beard is awesome.
There's nothing weird about that.
I said, thank you. I've been working on it. I appreciate that. Total stranger. Your beard is awesome.
Now, if you could call my wife and tell her that, now that would be weird. Yeah.
I told my wife, if the kiss quotient goes up, the beard length goes down.
Yeah.
It's that simple, Matthew.
It's
that simple. As you could see from the fact that I look like Rip Van Winkle now, not a lot of kisses going on. In any case, VikingOilsLLC.com, that's where you can get your amazing beard products that you will love, and I can vouch for them because I use them every day.
Mm.
Now let's talk about comics, Matthew. I'm going to kick us off today with a book that is the second installment of one that I talked about a little while ago, and that is The Old Guard. This is a series by Greg Rucka with art and covers by Leandro Fernandez, colors by Daniela Miwa, letters by Jody Wynn, and it is edited by Alejandro Arbona. And the blurb about it is, this is a fairy tale of blood and bullets. It is the story of two women and three men who cannot die, mostly. Their names are Andy, Nikki, Joe, Booker, and Niall. Now that their secret has been revealed, what will they do to protect each other? Now, what we saw in the first issue of The Old Guard was we found out that there was this group of warriors who were basically immortal. They had lived for hundreds of years, and in some cases, thousands of years. And they were now mercenaries. And so what had happened in the first issue is they were hired to do a job, and they kind of took some repeat business from someone, which is something they never do because they don't want to be exposed. But they took this repeat business because there were kids involved that were allegedly hostages. So they get their group together, and they go to the site where they're going to rescue these hostages, and they get there, and it was an ambush that was waiting for them. And the ambush was there for the sole purpose of recording on video the fact that these guys cannot be killed. And so whoever recorded it was recording it off-site and got away with that. So as we start the second issue of this series, the heroes have been exposed. Someone knows that they are out there in the world and that they're immortal, and that cannot possibly be good because what they've survived for this long because they keep a low profile. You know, they do these jobs and then they disappear and that kind of stuff. And what you get at the beginning of issue two is you get sort of a history that you didn't get in issue one. And Andy, who is the leader, she is kind of telling about some of the warriors that have been with them in the past. There was a woman by the name of Noriko who was with them for a couple hundred years, and she ended up eventually getting killed because what we find out is that you are immortal until the day that you're not. So these warriors could go thousands of years of being killed and then waking up 5 seconds later and being slain on the battlefield and getting right back up when the battle's over. And then one day, they don't get up. So they don't know when their immortality is going to be gone. And over the years, they've lost a couple from their group. And so you sort of get the history of everybody that's in the group now. You see, you know, the Crusades, you see these different wars that they were all involved in over the years and how they began to form relationships. Two of the guys began as mortal enemies, and now they're a couple because they tried to kill each other hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times, and it didn't work. And so finally, they just sort of gave up. Then you see she's the one, Andy, who has been around the longest. And because she's been around so long, she is the de facto leader of this group. And so once we sort of get that history, we have them regrouping and saying, look, someone knows who we are. We have to track down the contact that hired us for this job because they're the one that betrayed us. And until we do, and until we get that video and figure out who's doing this to us, then we're going to have targets on our back. And the world can't really know that we exist. Now, in the meantime, as they're sort of resting and getting ready to leave, they all have the same dream. They are all having dreams of someone new, someone who appears to be a soldier, someone who was involved in some sort of a conflict, and it looks like they died. And what you find out is that these immortals, whenever a new one comes into the world, the existing ones dream about them. And then they have to figure out how they can track them down. So as they all wake up from this dream of where they see this woman get killed, and they're kind of freaking out. And one of the guys, Nikki, is like, okay, grab a pad. Let's write down what we know. Okay, well, I dreamed it was a soldier of some sort. Well, I dreamed that this was the clothes that people were wearing, so we know that it's in this part of the world. I dreamed that this was the weapon that she was killed with, so we can narrow it down to this particular place. So they end up narrowing it down that I think she's in Afghanistan. So they end up narrowing down like where they think that she might be, and they realize that they can't go into hiding just yet, and they can't go after that contact just yet because they have to track down this new person. Because if someone new that is also immortal has just sort of shown up into the world, they have to get their hands on them before whoever it is that's trying to do them in. So they decide to go after her, and it's a very dangerous mission, but Andy decides that she's going to be the contact that does this. We also then flip over to the rich guy who is kind of paying for this whole operation to find out about the immortals. And you see that he's kind of a dude bro, and he's obviously got a ton of money, and he, it seems like, wants to figure out who these people are because he wants to know how they're immortal, because he wants to figure out how to take that power for himself, which kind of makes perfect sense. He wants to figure out how they do it so he can live forever. So now we cut over to Afghanistan, and you see this Marine, Freeman, who was the one that was killed in last issue, and how she came back to life, and she's still reeling from the fact that she thought she was dead, and then she wakes up in the infirmary. And everyone around her is freaking out because they thought she was dead, and she wakes up in the infirmary. But she comes out of the showers, and she gets dressed, and she's headed back to her barracks. And who's waiting outside for her but Andy, one of the immortals? And she ends up clocking her in the head and dragging her out into the middle of the desert. And when she wakes up, she's trying to explain to her, look, I took you because you're one of us. And this woman's like, I don't even know, who are you? And she's like, you're immortal now. You can't die. And the woman, of course, thinks that she's going crazy, so Andy pulls out a gun and shoots her. 2 minutes later, she wakes up, and she's like, how did that just happen? I'm supposed to be dead because I'm trying to tell you that you're immortal, and you're one of us. And again, the woman doesn't believe her, so Andy shoots herself and says, okay, so now you can see that I can't die too, and you can't die, so now you know that we share something in common, and I'm telling you that you have to come with us, and you have to get out of here because people know about us now. And when they find out that you're the new one on the block, they're going to come for you. And so we're not completely immortal. You know, we can't eventually die. You don't want to test that theory. Come with me. So she ends up following her to a safe house that they've all agreed to meet at. And when they get to the safe house, one of their compatriots has had his head pretty much completely blown off. I don't know if he's coming back from that or not, but the safe house has been compromised, so the people that have been hunting them already know where they all are, and that's the way that the second issue ends. So we've gotten a new person added to the team, and maybe one subtracted from the team, and clearly the people that have been tailing them are, in fact, one step ahead of them. So very good series so far. I love the flashbacks to the battles and the eras that these people have lived through before. I love the idea that there is a new one that comes along, maybe to replace one that has been lost along the way. And I love the fact that they don't know when their immortality is going to end. because they have no idea, and this comes up during the discussion, they have no idea how they've gotten these powers. They have no idea how long they last, what the genesis of them is. They don't understand any of it. So as the new person comes in and she's like, tell me all about this, they're like, yeah, we don't know. It just has been this way. This is the way that it is. So there's still a lot of questions to be answered in this series, but there's this sense of urgency because they're being pursued by people who know who they are now. So great stuff. It's from Image. The third issue is out now. If you're looking for a book that is definitely something different, pick this one up.
Cool. So when the DC Universe did their rebirth about a year and a half ago, one of the cool things that happened was there were a lot of Easter eggs put everywhere. And one of the big ones, if you remember that dollar issue where everybody and everything was coming back and Wally was walking around. Why
was it the prelude to Rebirth or something like that? Yeah.
There was the last couple pages, we all saw that familiar smiley face with a bullet hole and blood dripping off of it from The Watchmen.
Yep.
Now, The Watchmen is one of the more beloved DC stories ever of all time.
We did that for a summer reading project one year.
We certainly did. I was never one enamored very much with the story, with the comic, but I did really like the movie. But
I did too. Do you know that a lot of people have bad things to say about that movie?
Yeah, and I'm the complete opposite because everybody holds The Watchmen as one of the five greatest comics.
I thought
ever
it was like
out.
The one movie that Zack Snyder was perfect to make because it was supposed to be dark.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like it was supposed to be the deconstruction of superheroes.
Yeah.
I really liked it. I feel like I need to watch that again.
I know. So what's going on here is when they announced the Batman and Flash were going to be teaming up for a four-issue arc called The Button, I was excited, first of all, because Batman and Flash are my two favorite DC characters. Throw in the smiley face and you're throwing in a whole different element of everything. Throw in a couple lenticular changing covers and you've got me lock, stock,
they
and
had you at lenticular.
They did. So written by Tom King, Jason Fabok is the artist on this one, and one of the best artists in the industry right now. I've been saying that for about a year, but this guy just keeps getting better and better and better. I'm hoping he's going to be at New York because I would love to chat with him. Brad Anderson is a colorist, and Mark Doyle is the editor. Darren Bennett is the letterer. So we start out at a hockey game, and you see some inmates at Arkham watching the hockey game, and I believe one of them is Harley Quinn because there aren't a whole lot of blonde women locked up in Arkham. And she is there, and they're talking about this game, and you see the face-off going on. The one stick comes in, then the other stick comes in. Then they pan back, and they're talking about how these two guys in the face-off circle have been at each other's throats all year, and with a trip to the playoffs at hand, this could get ugly. And all of a sudden, before anything even happens, you have Harley hearing they're going to kill him. And I'm assuming it's Harley. We'll just say the blonde in the prison. And you got it's a Schuster and Taylor in the face-off, and they're playing, doing the play-by-play. She's like, stop it, stop it, stop it. It needs to stop. And she says, Superman won't come. Our friends will die. The Legion will die. So I'm even wondering, is it Supergirl? When Supergirl went into the future to join the Legion. But that's the fun of this. You don't know what anything is. You don't know what anything has to do with anything. So she starts crying and freaking out, going, nobody's going to stop it. Nobody's going to stop it. Now you go to the Batcave, and you got Batman, who has all the smiley face button images on his screen. I'll show you, Brian.
He's in full-on detective mode, Matthew.
However, TV in the corner, he's watching the hockey game. That's a Batman after my own heart. So
has it been established that Batman's a hockey fan?
Apparently he is, because he's watching this game. He's got the button, and all of a sudden, and it's Central City versus Gotham, trip to the playoffs at stake. Now, the two guys start to get into a fight. Now, the rules of hockey are once you bested your dude, because most fighters, that's part of their job. They don't hold any grudges towards anybody. Once the fight is over, you will sometimes see them patting each other on the back, going, dude, that was an awesome fight. And that, if you're not around it a lot, that can be very weird to watch. I've been around people going, they were just bashing each other's brains out. Why are they skating to the penalty box high-fiving each other? Because it's their job, and they're applauding each other's fight. So unwritten rule, you stop punching when the guy goes down. And during this fight, the guy goes down, and the other dude, I believe it's from Central City, just keeps wailing on him to the point where he's got him now. You see his head completely cranked the other way, and he kills him. Punches him and beats him up so bad, he kills him. You've got the team is jumping on each guy to try to pull him off to get this to stop. And then the screen goes blank. And Batman is holding, the button that is on a shelf now falls off the shelf. and falls onto the mask of Psycho Pirate. Because in the last bunch of Batman stories, Psycho Pirate has been a part of that. He just got Psycho Pirate back from Bane, I believe, and now he's got the mask here. So something happens when the button hits Psycho Pirate's mask, and all of a sudden this zap of lightning comes out, and then all you do is you see a guy dressed as Batman, and you'll get a little charge out of this. The Batman guy stands there and goes, Bruce, and then Batman goes, Father. Mm. It's Flashpoint Batman.
Okay.
So Flashpoint Thomas Wayne Batman shows up, and he says, Flash the button, and then he starts yelling, Flash the bloody button I found in the cave after Wally disappeared. I was looking over it. It fell on the Psycho Pirate's mask. Something is going on. So he's talking to Barry, and Barry's like, hey, Bruce, can you give me a minute? I'll be there in a minute. I'm taking care of some things. And you see him beating down some dudes. And he's like, the radiation, something's up with this, and something weird is going on because I thought I just saw my father dressed as Batman. And so he's like, okay, just give me a minute. So now you see the clock winding down, and Batman goes, all right, and he's holding on to the badge, and he said, you said a minute, Flash, of all the people I would expect you, not this early, Barry. And then the guy goes, Flash? No. And you turn the page, and it is Reverse Flash, and Reverse Flash punches Batman in the face, and then you see for every panel, so there are literally 55 panels, every single panel has a second in it, and Batman getting beat up pretty bad by Reverse Flash.
Because they're doing the Watchmen layout, right?
Yeah.
So all the panels are the same layout as Watchmen
yep.
was. Yeah.
Yep. So it is, and that's a very good pickup on that one. So he's saying, my name is Eobard Thrawn. I've been dead for some time, and I should be dead for some more time. And then he just starts beating on him, and he's beating him, and he looks down and sees the button. Now, as he looks down to go grab the button, Batman jumps out to get him. He vibrates, and he falls through him. And he's like, oh, I didn't know you wanted to still fight. So for the next 6 pages, he just gets the crap beat out of him. Batman may get a couple shots in there, but it's constant things going back and forth. Now, one of the most touching and emotional parts of all of Flashpoint was the letter.
Yes.
The letter that Thomas Wayne wrote to his son to give Flash, when he went back to his reality, give this to my son. And then all of a sudden, you have Reverse Flash picks it up, and he's like, oh, Thomas. He's like, this is what you did after you killed me, before you died, before your world died. And then he rips the letter up. And then sprinkles it all over Batman and starts saying, I hope that made you feel a little bit better, Thomas. Are you blurred? How are you feeling right now? Because right now I feel fantastic. And then Reverse Flash just keeps ripping the pieces even smaller, throws them all over the place. Batman's laying there all beat up and almost dead. All the pieces are on of him. Batman's like, get out of my cave. And he's like, oh, what are you going to do about it, baby Bat? Remember when I blurred? You know, when I blur, nobody can touch me. And he's like, yeah, but you have to be able to move to blur. So Batman gets a batarang, jams it right into his foot, locks him to the floor. Now he can't blur. So Batman gets up, gets a couple punches in, starts wailing him around. He then gets thrown into one of the back computers. And you see Reverse Flash vibrate off the batarang that has been holding his foot on the ground. And they just keep going back and forth. He's like, you know, I got to know. I got to know why you keep fighting when you know you can't win. He goes, I know, but I need to win. And he said, I just need 11 more seconds. So then the fight goes on. He's still getting beat up pretty bad. And then all of a sudden, he counts to one. And he says, overtime. And then he punches him. He punches Batman out. And then he's going, pathetic. And then he looks. He picks up the button, and now the button is all over the screen again, and he disappears. But then he comes back, and Reverse Flash is kind of pulling a Flash during Crisis, where he's starting to fall apart. His skin's starting to burn off of him. The uniform's burning. And he's like, I can't, God, what do I do? And then all of a sudden, Flash shows up. He's like, hey, Bruce, you know, hey, I was here. I just wanted to stop off at the Blades game to see if I could save Taylor. But the guy died on the ice before I could even get there. I was just a little slow. And then you turn the last page, and you've got Batman laying on the floor, a burned up Professor Zoom on the floor, and Batman showing up. And for the first time in a long time, I will say, thank God these comics are coming out once a week. Because I read this book, honestly, 5-6 times. Could not get enough. I was then looking for every little thing. I was trying to find all the little details. But this is a series right now. It's going to be 4 issues. This could have a huge impact on what is going on in the future DC universe. There are a lot of things at stake. I am really interested to see who the blonde girl was, because it could have been Harley Quinn. But when she was talking about the Legion dying, it made me think back to when Supergirl went into the future and hung out with the Legion and kind of went a little crazy. So interesting to see what's going to happen. Now, the good thing is you guys only have to wait about 5 minutes for...
Now, is Gotham Girl still in that series? Because doesn't Gotham Girl have blonde hair?
Oh, you know, I don't know if that was Gotham Girl or not. Is she... It very well could have been.
Uh-huh.
Because they didn't say who it was.
I'm a few issues behind on Batman, so I haven't even caught up to that one yet.
And then when we talk about the Flash one, there's another cameo of a character.
Matthew,
we haven't
if you want to talk about the Flash one right now.
Nope, we're going to.
You're going to take a breather? Okay.
Yep, you get yours.
All right. So let's jump over to Action Lab Comics in the Danger Zone.
Oh, yeah.
And talk about Spencer and Locke. This is a series that is written by David Peepos, art by Jorge Santiago Jr., colors by Jason Smith, letters by Colin Bell. Spencer and Locke is about a detective whose partner is his imaginary friend. And he is a talking Blue Panther.
Nice.
So what's cool about this is it kind of goes back and forth between shots of this kid's childhood, which are drawn like Calvin and Hobbes. Except it's Spencer and Locke. So you have Spencer and Locke who are sneaking out of the house at night to go riding in their red wagon. And you have Locke, who's a little kid, saying, boy, you think with all the sleepovers Mom has, she'd want to stay up and watch Letterman. And the imaginary friend is laughing because he knows why Mom has all the sleepovers.
Yeah.
So they're riding around in their wagon outside and they end up crashing into a tree. But instead of the funny sort of happy ending that your usual Calvin and Hobbes strip has, this one ends with his mother finding out that he snuck out and beating the living daylights out of him.
That is not like Calvin and Hobbes.
So you can see that his childhood was maybe a little bit different and a little bit traumatic, which is maybe why he still has an imaginary friend. But now we fast forward to the future and you have Detective Locke, who is sitting in an alleyway looking at the dead body of a woman that he used to be really good friends with in his childhood. Her name is Sophie, and she has been killed. She's a school teacher, and he is there to figure out who killed her. And as he's examining the crime scene, you can see in the background his partner's putting the rubber gloves on so they can start looking at the evidence. And then you see when his partner takes a little bit of blood and goes to sniff it, that his partner is a giant Blue Panther. And you see that he is a detective whose partner is his imaginary friend. So now we go over to the diner where he and Spencer is the name of his partner, who has a button for one of his eyes because the stuffed animal that he has the imaginary friend from lost an eye at some point in time. Mm. So he has a button as in his sort of live action version of himself. They're sitting there talking about the evidence that they found and that the tool that was used to kill her. The evidence suggests that it was a razor blade, maybe from someplace like a barbershop or something like that. So they're sitting there talking, and Spencer, the cat, is drinking a juice box while his partner's having coffee and having a cigarette. And the waitress comes by, and she's like, excuse me, but who are you talking to? And then the camera turns around, and you see him sitting there, and in the other booth is a stuffed animal. And he's like, it's a private conversation. Get out of here. So you see that like he carries his stuffed animal around with him, but he sees him as his partner. So now we go back to sort of a comic strip version of Spencer and Locke, and you see that Sophie was a girl who had a crush on Locke when he was a little kid. So he's got a vested interest in wanting to find out who killed her. This is personal for him. You also see him talking about sort of the life that he escaped and the fact that it seems like his childhood was very rough. He ended up leaving town at one point to get away from his old life, and now that he's become a detective, he is back in his hometown. And that's very bittersweet for him. So he ends up going to his old school where Sophie was now a teacher. And he sees the old woman who used to be his teacher is now the principal of the school. And she's kind of a miserable old lady. And she's talking about what a terrible student he was. And they're kind of going back and forth. Then they go to the house of Sophie. And you see that she lives with her mother. And as they get in there and they're examining her room for evidence, they hear cries coming from the closet. And he turns around and he sees that Sophie had a daughter. And the daughter is in the closet crying, holding her stuffed animal because her mom's gone. And the cool part, the most emotional part of the book for me was that he then pulls out his stuffed animal and he says, hey, this is Spencer. He's a real live panther and he's a cop just like me. And he gives the stuffed animal to the girl. And then you see a picture of Spencer as his like live action self giving the girl a hug. So she can see him too. So that was really kind of cool. And he's talking about, you know, do you think of anybody that could have done this to your mom? And she talks about the mom's boyfriend who happens to be the bully that used to torment Locke when he was a little kid. That is the kid that Sophie was dating now as she became an adult. And so you see that he now even has more of a vested interest in this because this is a kid who used to torment him. So they end up tracking down the barbershop where they think the weapon came from. And they get in there and they find a panel in the floor that stuff is being stored in. And he's trying to find out what's in there. And it looks like there's some that there's the actual weapon that might have been stored underneath this, you know, floor panel. And as he's going to get it, who shows up but this bully? And I think his name is Stanley. And he ends up getting into a huge fight with Locke. And they're going back and forth. And you sort of see Locke's imaginary friend jumping into the fight and helping him, but you're not clear if that's actually happening or if it truly is just an imaginary friend. But he ends up finally getting the better of this guy, Stanley, and beating the crap out of him and subduing him. And so they're going to take him in now. And we go back to the little girl's house to where her mom was just killed. And you see that the little girl is sitting in the living room with her grandmother, and she finally seems to be in a place where she stopped crying, and she's doing a little bit better, except these bunch of goons show up to her house and start shooting out the windows and kill her grandmother. Mm. And all of a sudden, they kick the door down, and the little girl says, who are you? And he says, the name's Locke, Augustus Locke, but you can just call me Grandpa. Which then suggests that this little girl is not only the daughter of Sophie, but she's the daughter of Locke. And he doesn't know that.
Mm.
And that this is Locke's father, which would explain why he had a bad childhood, because his dad seems to be involved in some pretty nasty stuff. This was a great first issue. Not only is it a interesting murder mystery, but the whole idea of the imaginary friend being his detective partner, like, is awesome. And the way that they played it off when other people see the stuffed animal that he's carrying around with him. Like, very cool first issue of the book. Again, this is an Action Lab Danger Zone book. So if you haven't checked out Spencer and Locke, I think the second issue might be out now, but definitely worth picking up.
Are you watching Imaginary Mary?
No.
The new show with Jenna Elfman? Very good.
I have not. You know how awful I am at watching television? Like, I am truly the worst television watcher ever. I am behind on all of the CW shows.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like one episode behind on Riverdale. I finally almost got caught up. That's why we haven't been able to do a boob tube and big screen, because I haven't been caught up on anything. I finally caught up to Flash, but then missed this week's episode
because I
worked late last night. I'm one episode behind on Arrow still, and I'm like half a season behind on Supergirl. So I'm awful. So every time somebody's like, hey, you need to watch this new show, I'm like, I can't even keep up with like the four shows that I've decided I was going to watch this year. I'm terrible at it.
Yeah, so that sounds really, really good. So we are now going to jump back into the DC Universe, and we are going to jump back into The Button. This is part two. This one is in The Flash number 21, written by Joshua Williamson, and Howard Porter does the art, Hi-Fi the colors, Steve Wan's the letters, and the editor is Brian Cunningham. So I don't even have to recap what happened in the last issue because I just talked about it.
That was about 5 minutes ago.
If I
remember correctly, just to recap for our listeners, Matthew, Batman was in a bad state.
Yeah. He got the crap beat out of him.
Zoom looks like, a reverse Flash looks like he was melted into obscurity, and Barry showed up late to the party.
Yes, perfect. So first page, we have an old man on the rooftop of a building screaming, where are you, Thunderbolt? See you. See you. Johnny Lightning. So Johnny Lightning is now an old man looking for his lightning bolt. Or Johnny Thunder. Johnny Thunders? Johnny Lightning. Johnny Thunders.
I'm going to go with you on that. You're the DC historian around here.
Yeah, I think that it's Johnny Thunders, but it's – or Johnny Lightning. Anyway, he's got the lightning bolt, and he's part of the Justice Society.
Yep.
So now we're getting a look at the Justice Society, sort of like we saw, if you remember, in – what was that series, the DC one they did?
Was it Convergence?
Convergence, yes. I was thinking Containment. Might as well have been called Containment, where you had an old Justice Society trying to track down and fight, realizing that when they fought, they were all going to die because they were too old to keep it going. So you've got Johnny Lightning or Johnny Thunder, Mr. Thunder, Johnny Thunder. So Johnny Thunder's up there, and they're like, you got to get down from here. And they're trying to drag him, and they're like, well, this guy's got a lot of fight for a 90-year-old dude. They bring him downstairs, and they're like, look, tell the nurse he needs more meds. And he's like, the Lightning, it said we need my friends. I got to find my friends. We lost the Justice Society, and it's all my fault. Now you turn the page, and you get a little recap of Batman getting beat up as he's explaining to the Flash what happened. And Flash is there in the Batcave, and the Batcave is destroyed. All the tubes that have the costumes in them are all smashed. The big pennies off the ceiling, the dinosaurs not looking too good, and all the computers are destroyed. So he's going through and he's using sort of his deductive CSI mind, going through trying to find all the clues.
Let me ask a question, Matthew. Yes. Could the Flash not find and pick up and reassemble all the pieces of that letter if he wanted to?
Absolutely.
I mean, that would be my first thing, knowing that it's so important to Batman.
Could if he wanted to. So you see Reverse Flash laying on the floor, half bone, half costume left, and you've got all these little cards that said like 14, 3, 7. Those are all the clues that he finds because you're leaving it as a crime scene. So he's going through there, and he looks up and goes, it's over, Mom. And then he puts his cowl back on, and he starts looking, and he's like, well, you know what? This is Thrawn. He's got the same signature, the heat signature, the speed force, resonance is all there. So this definitely is him. And he goes, so I don't get this, though. Why is he here? I thought he was already dead. And then he skirts up into the back upstairs, and he sees Alfred, and he goes, any luck, Alfred? And he says, well, with all the Batcave surveillance equipment all damaged, I don't think so. And he goes, well, Thrawn's lightning must have really fried it. And that means that there is only one witness. And you turn the page, and I'll show you, Brian, you got Batman laying on a bed just beat to hell. He's got his bat
bottoms
on.
It's having a tough day.
Yep, bat bottoms on, all bandaged up, holding onto his ribs, cut up everywhere. And he said, wow, Thrawn said he saw God. And Batman said, yeah, with a capital G. And he goes, well, he was always more of a man of science than faith, but that seems a little odd that that would have been his last words. And Batman says, I'm well aware of how Thrawn was, his time-traveling abilities, all this stuff that's going on. I don't know why he was even here, but the button's gone, and all sorts of clues that we might have had to anything are all gone. And then Batman's like, look, I've gone back and forth through time. I'm going to go through the cave. I'll see if I can find out anything else going on. And he says, so, what do you think's going on? And then Batman says, DNA. And he goes, yep, match the one on record. Radiation. So all the things that Flash already deduced, he's now questioning him on. Because Batman is the world's greatest detective.
But Flash is a
forensic scientist.
Yes. So he would also check all those things, which is kind of cool. I mean, I would wish that we'd see more Batman and Flash team-ups on that front. Because and I like that they're playing up the sort of evidence gathering and examination piece of this, because those are two things that I feel like at times, depending on who's writing both of those characters, those get completely pushed into the background. But they're two of the more interesting aspects of the characters.
Yeah. So you have them going back and forth. And finally he goes, did you run multiple tests to compute the results? And he goes, Bruce, come on.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Of course he did.
It's like, Bruce, come on. And just the look on his face is perfect. And then you see Bruce put his head down. He goes, I'm sorry. He goes, look, we researched that button for a month and we found nothing. The blood on it didn't match any samples found. And this is where it's really cool, because now you're starting to hear some of the agencies. He says it didn't match up in any of the samples found in Argus, the DEO, or Star Labs. So you're kind of getting that DEO mention.
Sure.
So if you're somebody
pulling a couple other slices of the
reading
DC
stuff
universe.
In, he's like, yeah, but when you called me, you said the button reacted to contact with Psycho Pirate's mask. What do you think it was? And he goes, well, there was a ghost. He goes, what do you mean there was a ghost? And he explains, he goes, it was my father. And he goes, he came back, the bat suit similar to mine. And now this is cool, because this is where Barry goes, whoa, this, I'll read it exactly. That sounds like Flashpoint. That sounds like the Batman from Flashpoint. But how could you recognize him as your father? And then he, Batman says, well, I know it was him. I'd know him anywhere. Then he goes on and says, boy, that was when I went back in time to find the killer of my mother. And in that, I recreated a future that is 15 different things going on and very out of control. And I fear if some of those elements start to come back into this reality, what is the possibility? So right now, with just this one page, you have now brought everybody back in that might just be reading it because they know the TV Flash. You've now explained this because that is what's been going on in the Flash show, is all these things coming back from the different Flash points, all these different things. And then he's like, you know, Barry, I want you to know that I'll do whatever you can to help. But he goes, there's something that we're missing about that button. He's fixating on the button. And he goes, well, there's one piece of evidence that I can't find, and that's Thrawn's body. So now Batman or Flash goes up to the Justice League Watchtower, and he goes into a room and he says, you know, this is a great place. We call this the Hall of Lost and Found. And you've got a shot of all the crazy things. You got the Beatles bug. You've got a clipper, like a Viking ship from early Justice League adventures. You've got the Dial H for Hero thing right there. All these cool things that I spent quite a bit of time, probably way too much time, looking and trying to find it. Assorted capes, busted up skeets, you know, all sorts of cool stuff in there. And as he's going through, he's thinking about when he first saw Wally come back, and Wally was saying, you know, why doesn't anybody know me? I'm glad that you remembered me. And he's saying, you know, Wally was in the Speed Force, and he came back more powerful than he was when he left. And he obviously saw some things. I don't know what was going on, but there's only one thing to do to find out and how we can find it. And he pulls a curtain off of something, and it is the cosmic treadmill, which is what Flash used to use to jump back in and out of time back in the old days. So as he's talking about it and talking about all the different ramifications that he has had using it, he gets ready to jump on, and as he's starting to go, voice off camera says, you really think I'd let you go alone? And you turn around, and it's Batman, and he's in the suit. And I thought of you, Brian, in this one, because as he's walking away and it's all dark, you got two Starro starfish.
I love that, dude. It is the, if I'm not mistaken, it's the Rebels series.
Yep.
With Brainiac that did a whole Starro storyline that was one of the coolest Starro stories ever.
Yeah. And Batman's coming in and he's like, this is my case too, Barry. And as he's coming in, if you could add more sound effects to this picture, it would be, my ribs.
Right. A lot of cracking and scraping. Yeah.
And he's like, how did you know? And he goes, well, the vault alarm went off. And he's like, Bruce, with your injuries, you can't be doing this. He's like, I'm going to be jumping through time. I'm going to be running real fast. You need to hold on to me. And if you can't hold on to me, then you're going to end up somewhere in time. We may never find you. And he's like, you know what? You just do your run thing. I will do the holding on thing.
Right.
He's like, all right.
I know a thing or two about holding on.
Yep.
I've been holding on to painful memories since the day my parents died.
I like that. Yep. That was good. So as he's saying, he goes, no, I need to tell you, when we're running through this, you're going to be seeing a lot of things that are not normal. You're going to question them because you're going to see yourself know it's you, but it isn't you. So he's telling him all this stuff, and he's like, you know, you just got to be ready. So as they're running, all of a sudden Flash goes, and this would be kind of the scary part for me if I was Batman, because Flash goes, huh, I've never seen anything like this before. That's usually where problems start to arise.
Right.
Hey, I've done this a million times. Just hold on. Oh, I don't like this. He's like, the turbulence is making it hard to keep the treadmill steady. And then Batman's like, look, what is that? And you see old pictures of the Justice League done in the old styles. And you have Batman saying, we ought to form a club or society. And then Flash says, a league against evil. And then you got Flash going, well, that's not how the Justice League was formed. And Batman's like, are these alternate realities? Then you're seeing another one where they meet Zatanna. And he said, Wally told me years were taken from us. So these are all, they may all be alternate realities, but the way that I remember Wally saying, yeah, this has all happened. We just don't remember it happening. So very interesting to see. Then as they're running through, the last part is Flash during Crisis looking at Batman going, the world is dying. It's dying. It may already be dead. Save us, save us, save us. And then he disappears. So then Batman's like, what was that? He goes, don't even worry about it. We just got to keep going. Got to run faster, faster, faster. And then the cosmic treadmill explodes. And they both go flying. And all of a sudden, they disappear into like that 0 hour void.
Yep.
Which I don't know if it's 0 hour.
Did we ever go back and do 0 hour? I don't think we did.
I thought we did Final Night.
We did Final Night, but that was just a quick thing. Yeah. But I don't think we did 0 hour with all the Zero issues and stuff like that.
That's definitely something we should do. We should probably go back and do 0 hour. So the treadmill crashes, and then they wake up, and they're like, oh, what's going on? And Flash is like, the treadmill is destroyed. This is not good for any of us. And he goes, Batman's like, Flash, I know this place. I'd know it anywhere. He goes, I've known it since I was a little kid. I used to come down here as a child. My father found me, got mad at me. And Barry's like, uh-oh. And he goes, I don't know if we went back in time or where we went. And then you just see Barry or Batman getting so focused. Barry goes, Bruce, I need you to listen to me. I need you to focus. And then he looks over and sees a picture on the mantle of the three of them, of Batman, of Thomas, Martha, and Bruce Wayne. And he looks over and sees a gun in a showcase. And he goes, I never recovered that. How is it here? And he's like, Barry, why are we here? Where are we? And then you have off camera a voice saying, I did this all because of you. And you turn the page and it is old Batman looking at Batman saying, I did this all for you, son. And Flash is sitting there like, this is not good. And then that is how this ends. And it says, next in Batman 22, Flashpoint, Batman, father and son. So another one where, again, it just keeps – this is something that I think we are going to look at back in a few years and go, this was one of the best series to come out of this. We've only got two issues in and we've got two issues left, which I like the fact that that's we're very limited. They are not dragging this thing out. We're going to be getting some action. It may spin off into another story. It may end up being like an Aquaman Green Lantern four-parter that comes out of this. But this is brilliant. This is amazing. They also – I failed to mention, too, that they give credit to Geoff Johns, Tom King, and then in the Batman one, they give credit to Joshua Williamson because it's basically the two of them are writing it, but Geoff Johns is kind of navigating it, and he was also Flashpoint, so and all the crises that went on. So great to have him involved. Great to have this. This has just been a ton of fun.
Interesting.
Yes.
Well, I have both of those issues at home waiting for me, so I can't wait to dig into them. And just for overall theories, clearly, when you talked about Reverse Flash saying that he saw God, Dr. Manhattan, right? I mean, that's what you're thinking in that scenario.
Yeah.
So then it just goes to like, well, how does he figure into all of this? Is this the beginning of that? I hope it's not the beginning of them messing with Rebirth. You know what I mean? Like going back on it at all, because I would hate to see them do that, because I think Rebirth has been a step in the right direction for them. You know what I mean? Like I'd hate to, because clearly like Marvel's going through another reboot right now. And I would hate to see DC start to go down that road again, because I think that they found the right path with Rebirth
and they
should stick to that.
What I really am hoping it is I really hope that this is a clearly defined return to the multiverse of Earth 1, Earth 2, Earth 3, Earth Prime, Earth C, Earth S, all these Earths that we had when I was growing up that they got rid of during Crisis and then sort of brought back. Because when you think of the multiverse now, it is 52 different versions of Earth. I love the fact that we used to have 52 completely separate galaxies, entities. Every Earth had their Mars and Jupiter and Saturn. So I really am hoping that it's going to be something like that. But right now, I guess, after I closed my issue, I was able to shut my brain off and say, just get me on the next one because I'm really excited.
Yeah, it's a good story.
Yep.
All right, well, that wraps up our comic books this week, and that brings us to our creator spotlight. Now, this week's creator spotlight is Mr. Justin Bow, who is the creator of a role-playing game called Fey Noir. Now, I'm just going to read you quickly the blurb. He's going to talk about it more, as you'll hear in the interview, but it says, it is the roaring 20s, and everyone wants to forget the horrors of a war that spanned continents and dimensions. But the changes it wrought are not so easily dismissed. Humanity struggles to understand a world of reawakened magic and folklore come to life. The Fey, failed invaders from the lands of Faerie, find themselves adrift in the unfamiliar modern world, living relics of the past. It is an era of jazz and exploration, of art deco and danger, a time when the fists and courage of individuals can determine the course of history. Fey Noir is a role-playing game set in the chaotic, pivotal decade of an alternate world where creatures of mythology return from self-imposed exile at the height of World War I. This is the core book, and it goes on to explain the rules and stuff like that. So Fey Noir is a role-playing game that is sort of fantasy meets the Roaring Twenties. And that alone was super exciting for me when I saw the description of that. But what I talked to Justin about is not only that game, but the fact that he is now doing a Kickstarter campaign in order to do a comic that spins out of Fait Noir. Mm. And so in this interview, he talks about both the game and also how the idea for the comic came about and what the comic is really about and the upcoming Kickstarter campaign. And the cool thing is that right now, you can go to our show notes and you can get a link to the Kickstarter campaign, which has either just started or will be starting very soon. But I'm also going to link to the Drive-Thru RPG page where you can get a copy of the rule book for Fait Noir, the role-playing game, for $1 during the time that this Kickstarter campaign is going on. So not only can you go and check out a cool comic book that's going to be spinning out of this world, but you can get the actual game that it was based on for $1 right now, which is really exciting. And it was great to talk to Justin. We ended up catching up over the phone, and it was the first time we had ever chatted, and it was great to hear sort of how this whole project started and where he got these ideas from, and then how it went on to become a comic book. Because I'm a big fan, as we talked about on the show before, of ideas that span different mediums, right? Something that starts as a novel and then becomes a video game and gets adapted to a movie and has a comic book. Like, worlds that I find interesting are things that I want to be able to immerse myself in different ways. So a lot of times we see something start as a comic book property and then it gets adapted into other things. It's cool to see this start as a role-playing game and then make its way into comics as well. So Justin Bowe is your creator spotlight for this week. That is going to wrap it up for this episode of the Secret Identity Podcast. So for Mr. Matthew A. Herring, this is Brian Letenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week, and we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
Alrighty, this is Brian here, and today I am joined by creator Justin Bowe, who is the creator and designer of the Fait Noir RPG. How are you today, sir?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm very good. Thanks for taking some time out of your day to talk not only about the game, but about a very exciting project that's coming out of it. So, and I have to thank our friend Matt McElroy, who, of course, introduced us over Gmail, because he kind of knows by now that when he knows my tastes, I guess. So when he sees something that he thinks like, oh, Brian would love to talk about this, he'll sort of like shoot me an email. And this week he was like, hey, you should talk to this guy because he's doing a comic out of this awesome RPG that he had created. So before we talk about the comic, let's talk a little bit about the Fait Noir RPG, because when I read your description over on Drive-Thru RPG, like, it immediately jumped out at me. Like, you know, the sort of fantasy races meets the Roaring Twenties to me sounds like a match made in heaven. So how did that whole thing come about, and what's sort of the overview of Fait Noir?
Well, this might sound a little weird, but I actually had a dream about fantasy creatures in the 1920s and kind of ran with that because I was like, that's a really cool setting idea. And I had been previously working on what's widely known as a fantasy heartbreaker game. and I kind of just walked away from that once I realized, you know, the mythological fantasy setting is nothing new. It's been done so many times. And I felt like putting fairy creatures in the 20s was really special. So that was where that came from.
I totally agree. I mean, that immediately popped out at me when I read the description of that. Of course, growing up as a D&D kid and you know, growing up on Dragonlance novels and Lord of the Rings and all that stuff, I obviously was super into fantasy, but I love to see that mashup with sort of different time periods, different genres. And so so you decide to go down this road. Now you have to create an entire, because you didn't use an existing engine, you created a whole new engine for your game, correct?
Right. And the engine for the current edition of Fait Noir is definitely a product of the early 2000s. And I'm planning on doing a second edition of that, hopefully by next year, stripping out some of the clunkier combat mechanics. But the setting is going to remain unchanged. Right now, it supports both magic elements, fey illusion powers, and additionally faith-based miracles, in addition to standard combat and social maneuvering. But I want to really refocus so that it more supports noir-style gaming, leveraging people's social, personality flaws, and focusing on story elements. Like, if you say my character needs to show up and bust through the skylight at this point, you can make that happen by turning in-game resources, you know, really bringing it up to date with where gaming is now.
Yeah, and to me, like, that's one of the most difficult things, right? Because you have this very clear vision for your setting and the sort of atmosphere that you want to evoke, and then you have to make these mechanics work within that in a way that not only is entertaining and interesting game to play, but also lets that atmosphere kind of bleed through. And that, I mean, just even taking that on from the first place and you know, going through playtesting and all that kind of stuff, I mean, that was that like the most difficult part of the process, is sort of bringing those two elements together?
I think playtesting was definitely difficult, mostly because I went in with my vision of how these mechanics were going to work. And obviously, once that comes into contact with real gamers, it doesn't matter how much of a munchkin or a power gamer or rules lawyer you are, people are always going to find something that you missed when you're designing a game. So seeing how people were interacting with it, and you have to be really almost egoless when you do game design. Otherwise, you leave problems in that could have been fixed that people show you in the playtesting stage. And honestly, Feanor has been around for 10 years now, and so, you know, having that additional 10 years of playtesting is showing me areas that I want to fix for the second edition again, which I'm working on now. It's including a lot of house rules that we use. So it's going to be more streamlined and, again, play up these elements of the setting and the noir genre and sort of the deadliness and focusing on these social conflicts a little more.
Which makes perfect sense, too, in the life cycle of a role-playing game, right? Because when you look at any major role-playing game that has managed to survive more than a few years, eventually they go through an edition update. Eventually they go, whether they call it that or not, right? They go through and they streamline mechanics, they update things, they expand some of the storytelling elements of it. And so to have gotten this feedback over 10 years and now to getting into another edition, that seems like a natural evolution of what you've done up to this point.
Yeah, and I would say Palladium Games may not update their system, but that, I think that's the only one that does.
Right, exactly. There are certainly exceptions to the rule, for sure. But, you know, we talked about the sort of setting and the atmosphere and the mashup mm-hmm. element of Feanor. Clearly, that was something that you then thought might work in other mediums as well, because we're sort of talking today because there is going to be a comic that is set in the world of Feanor. And so how long was that sort of idea percolating, and how did it lead to what is now going to be the Kickstarter?
Well, let me start off, because I'm sure most of your listeners aren't necessarily familiar with the setting of Feanor, but basically, Feanor comes from the idea that during the Renaissance era in the early 1400s, the creatures of faerie look around and they say, humans are getting too good at science, they're getting too good at magic. Obviously, the reason they're doing so well is that we're inspiring them. We are so cool that if we all go away and take all of the magic out of the world, what sounds good to everybody 500 years? Okay. Then humans will go back to the Dark Ages without our amazing inspiration. During the time, this 500-year period, rulership of the Fae court switches from Seelie to Unseelie, and the Unseelie say, new plan, we're not going to go back and just live like we used to. We're going to go back and knock the humans back to the Stone Age, and we'll rule the world. It's going to be fantastic. Not being great forward planners, they, instead of scouting appropriately, they all kind of jump out in 1918 with the goal of conquering humanity. And this is the middle of World War One, and humans say, holy crap, magic. The Fae say, holy crap, mustard gas. The war, after a significant 6-month period of humans basically fighting just the Fae, the war ends up wrapping up mostly like it did in our timeline. But the Fae do manage to conquer Long Island. It's part of a deal where this particular royal house of faerie is a permanent ally of the United States in exchange for all of Long Island except for Brooklyn. And then because they saw how scary human technology had gotten during this 500-year period, the Fae said, well, we can't take our eyes off humanity anymore. Otherwise, something even worse is going to happen 500 years from now. They might even find a way to get into Arcadia and conquer us. So now everybody is sort of integrating in the 1920s and learning to live together. And so having written this very complex setting, I was thinking about these stories in the Feanor universe all the time. And each adventure is really kind of a mini story.
Is this a comic that's going back to explore that origin story of how this setting came to be, or is this a comic that's going to pick things up sort of as they are now, or something that happened along the way, so to speak?
I would describe the comic as a classic post-World War I immigrant tale about a goblin and a troll featuring the undead.
Okay, I like that.
And the invasion of Long Island. So the comic actually switches between the current day in 1924 and what happened during the invasion of Long Island during World War I, following this goblin and troll as the two main characters. In the modern day period, they also have a friend, Franklin, and Agatha, who are humans that they are collectively sort of a private detective force, because that's basically the only way they could get any work after World War I. So it switches back and forth between the past of this of Nero and Darby, who are the goblin and troll respectively, and their experiences during the war and kind of how that shaped them and why they decided to immigrate to the United States, and then what's going on with one of their cases in the current era.
So it sounds like even though this comic could be something that fans of the game who have been playing it will get a lot out of, because it sort of further expands the lore of the game and gives you a little bit more insight into, you know, some of the characters that were affected by these events, it also seems pretty new reader friendly in terms of maybe introducing people with the flashbacks to the origin and also with what the current sort of status quo is in the world. So was that your aim, to kind of be able to make this a treat for fans of the RPG already, but also maybe attract some people to the property that weren't familiar with it at all?
Truthfully, my aim was to tell a really great story. If it happens to attract people to the RPG, that's great. I just wanted to set a really exciting story in the Feanoir setting. I think there's a lot of richness both in what I've created, but also in the 1920s themselves. People don't realize the completely insane things were happening in the 1920s. The last Wild West-style train robbery was in, I think, 1921. I'm not looking at my cheat sheet, so I might be a little off on some of these. But a guy in Wyoming derailed a train, went on with a couple of six-shooters, and robbed everybody at gunpoint. There was an Apache attack in Arizona in the early 20s where they went and killed everybody on a ranch and then fled into Mexico. I mean, people don't realize it's the 1920s are this weird pivotal decade where we think of it as this fancy New York, cars are being created, and technology is exploding. But at the same time, even in the United States, it's still like the Wild West. And that's ignoring, you know, what Western Canada would have been like with, you know, basically Paul Bunyan era stuff happening there. Things that would completely blow the mind of a modern person that this is happening in the lifetime of some of our living grandparents.
Right. And then you're pulling in these fantastical elements as well that can add a completely different layer to it. So obviously, as you mentioned, the potential for different stories to come out of that time and then the fantastical elements that you've added to it are literally endless. And so for the Kickstarter, like, what's your scope of that Kickstarter? Is this for the first series of stories? Is this sort of a one shot? Is it a mini series? How does the Kickstarter look?
The first 6-issue story arc has been written. The Kickstarter is just for the first issue. And hopefully this will get people interested in doing the follow-up 5 issues. I originally had been looking at doing the full 6 issues as kind of a graphic novel, but it seemed, as a first-time comic Kickstarter person, it would be more realistic to get this put out, because honestly, my goal is to make sure that the story is told and that we get really good art out there and on a timeline that we can hit. Having done RPG Kickstarters before, I know that, you know, managing the timeline is really important, and I want to make sure that all of the backers get what they're paying for.
And have you sort of settled on what sort of rewards you're going to have for different tiers of the Kickstarter already?
Comic tiers are pretty standardized, it seems like. $5 for just the PDF version, $10 for hard copy shipped in the United States. I'm still looking at doing some additional goals for the $25 and $50 tier, whether that's going to be a postcard, you know, from Brooklyn with something like Greetings from the Battle of Brooklyn, or Wish You Were Here with maybe the Statue of Liberty as the Green Fairy or something along those lines.
Yeah.
I think that's going to be a pretty reasonable tier for 25 or 50. And then at 100, it'll be, you know, have your face drawn as one of the background characters. For $250, there are a few tertiary characters that we can have modeled after people, and then $500 actually is pretty special. One of the major characters for the entire Feanoir comic franchise could be designed after you.
That's an awesome reward.
Yeah, and if nobody takes it now, it's gone forever.
Right, so it's like a one-shot deal.
Yeah, once the guy's drawn, that's it. We have to keep drawing him the same way for the rest of the series. So hopefully someone will get their face on the fairy godfather.
And we're going to have a link in our show notes to the Kickstarter, which is going to be happening as this particular interview goes up. But also, I noticed that over at DriveThruRPG, you are running a humongous deal on the Feanoir RPG right now, pretty much during the length of this Kickstarter, right?
Yes, we are dropping the price for the Feanoir PDF to $1 for the entire length of the Kickstarter so that people can get a hold of that in advance of Feanoir 2nd Edition and obviously in support of the Kickstarter.
Yeah, I mean, and there's really no reason for people not to go check that out. I mean, if you haven't already been enticed by, you know, what we've been talking about, for a dollar to go and check out this fully formed role-playing game with the setting and really get an idea of what you can expect from the comic, that's a no-brainer to me. So there'll be a link in the show notes to that as well. So for people who want to keep up with what you're doing, not only with Feanoir, but maybe other projects that you're involved in, where's the best place for them to catch up with you online?
The Green Fairy Games Facebook page is usually kept pretty up to date. It hasn't been updated for the past couple of months because I've been focusing on getting the Kickstarter put together rather than launched. And then I do occasionally update the website, but that's not as up to date as the Facebook page.
Well, we will definitely put a link to the in the show notes for that Facebook page as well. And I really appreciate you taking time to talk about both the game and the comic with us. There will be links to the Kickstarter and to all of those pages in our show notes. And we will definitely check in with you as the Kickstarter sort of proceeds. And you can keep us posted on how things are going and what's coming down the road for Feanoir. But I appreciate your time today. And I hope you have a really successful Kickstarter project.
Thank you. It was great talking to you.
The rest of the comic publishing world may finally be arriving to the party, but DriveThru Comics is the one that started it all. The first downloadable comic shop is still leading the way when it comes to digital comics. Featuring hundreds of publishers, excellent prices, and top-notch customer service, DriveThru is a great experience all around. Another thing that sets DriveThru apart from a lot of other digital comics platforms is this. When you buy a comic, you own it. You get a watermarked PDF file that you can read on your laptop, your tablet, phone, or any other device. You choose how you enjoy the comics you buy. So head over to DriveThruComics.com today, and on your way to checking out, download a free issue of Secret Identity.